fuzzy felt at the service of the gospel. So you've got a big screen, you've got the flannel, and then you put your fuzzy felt figures and things up onto the screen. Flannelgraph is great because, well, two things about flannelgraph. It doesn't need any electricity. And if you sit on it, you can't break it because it's felt. And I do sit on things and break them, so it does it. But a flannelgraph is absolutely fantastic because you've got there a whole world. You see, there's a background. You could have a landscape. You could have buildings, and you can have figures. And as you tell the story, you put the figures up. It's marvelous. Absolutely wonderful. I had one and I gave it away, so very disappointed. I think what Luke has got in this chapter is a flannelgraph, but with words. He's painting pictures, isn't he? He's painting pictures, the hill country of Judea. He's painting a landscape. We can almost imagine it, can't we? One of those Italian Renaissance paintings. It's probably in Tuscany or Florence, but nonetheless, it gives a picture, doesn't it? He creates a landscape, he creates a world, and he populates the world with figures, God's people, Jesus' family, first of all. And we can never forget that Jesus emerged from a familial context. He had a family, he had people who knew and related to him. And we'll be thinking a little bit after Christmas about Jesus being part of a family. So we won't go into that too much today. But Jesus is part of a world, his own family and the Jewish world. That world with all its troubles, with all its conflicts, with all its despairs, but also all its joys, its hopes, and its promises. The covenantal promises made by God Himself. Luke depicts that world, and he depicts, I always think, in the early pages of his gospel, the best of that world. Figures like Elizabeth, Zechariah, Simeon, Anna, John the Baptizer. He populates the world with familiar figures. Looking forward to the promises of God, looking forward to what God will do. And we have in those figures servants of God. Servants of God. Now, servants don't get a very good press, do they? And certainly not slaves. The two words in Greek for servant are translated are diakonos for a servant and doulos for a slave. Now you might think, well, I'll be a diakonos. I might be Mr. Hudson from Upstairs Downstairs or Mr. Carson from Downton Abbey. But you wouldn't want to be a doulos, would you? But what we have here are servants of God. And Mary herself talking about herself as a servant. It's not about, I think, submission. But it's about being in a place and a relationship with God. It's good to think about service, God's servants, and those servants from the Old Testament, those great figures, Joshua, Moses, Abraham, Hannah, others as well. And about Jesus himself as being a servant of God. During this Advent, I've been reading each day one chapter of Luke's Gospel. 24 days in Advent, 24 chapters in Luke. It kind of works out, doesn't it? And the chapter I got to this morning was the one about the upper room. That first Maundy Thursday, Jesus being in the upper room with his servant, with his disciples, instituting Holy Communion. And also seeing a conflict amongst his disciples about who is the greatest, who is the greatest. And Jesus saying, I'm among you as one who serves. I'm among you as one who serves. Service then and servanthood as being central to the gospel story. And I want to think about three aspects of Mary's servant hood. Three aspects. First of all, the humility of the servant. Mary does not exploit her position as God's servant, her exalted position as the mother of the Messiah. She doesn't exploit that position, but she magnifies God. My soul magnifies the Lord. The Magnificat, that's where we get that word from. Magnifying is about not making something larger than it already is. You can't make God any larger than he already is. But we can see God more clearly. That's what Mary does, doesn't it? She helps us to see God more clearly and his purposes, his loving purposes. Mary has that humility. She has that servant heart. Out of that humility, she says yes to God. She says yes to God's promises, yes to the risk of God, and to the heartbreak in our own life. She puts herself in a position of vulnerability. And from that, her authority emerges. From that humility and from that vulnerability, her authority emerges. Or rather, God's authority and power flows through her. She puts herself in that vulnerable position, willingly, honestly. She puts herself in that position as not one who is seeking power, not one who in fact has any power, an ordinary person, chosen by God, who allows God's purposes to work through her. The humility of the servant. And now the wisdom of the servant. The incarnation was life-changing for Mary, but also life-changing for the world. God acting in the here and now. God turning the world upside down. Or rather, I always say, putting the world the right way up. A transformation. Mary was transformed by God's power, by bearing her son, Jesus, the Messiah. And she had the wisdom and the prophetic insight to realize and to proclaim that what was happening in her and through her was revolutionary. The world will never be the same again. And it is so for us. Someone once said, the personal is political. I always say the personal is theological. What happens between God and ourselves personally has profound implications for us in the world. We can't contain it. It spreads. We meet with God, we are changed by him, we are converted. We are renewed, we are transformed, and that has implications from the world in which we live and in which we move and in which we are. It can be nothing else, can it, if we stop and think about it? That encounter with God which sometimes is desperate, sometimes a last grasp, a last throw of the dice on our part, sometimes surprisingly or sometimes reluctantly on our part, nonetheless is transformative for the world. Mary saw that, and she saw a world renewed, a world where the poor are lifted up, where the hungry are fed. She saw, in fact, I think, a revolution of mind, a change of heart, a renewal. And true change and true revolutions come not externally, but internally, from where we are, from being different, radically different. It's a revolution, I think, from the bottom up, not from the top down. That's what God's doing, isn't he, in the incarnation? That's what God's doing in Luke's gospel in particular. He's working from the bottom down, from the ordinary, from ordinary people, godly people, his servant people. He's working with ordinary people. He's working with shepherds. He's working with men and women who are just going about being who they are and who they think they should be. God is working with them, and he's working with us. Not with the elites, not with the powerful, although those will be drawn into this revolution and into this renewal. He's working with us as we are, in order to transform the world, in order to be different in the world. A world turned upside down, a world turned the right way up. A new thing, but in fact, a very old thing. Coming back to what I said at the beginning, the world that Luke sets out is the world of the covenant, the world of God's promises, the world of the temple. All those things in Luke's gospel will be important and remain important, but all those things will be renewed. A new covenant, a new temple, a new Israel, a new hope, a new beginning. All those things will be transformed. Something very old, and yet something very new. Something very familiar, yet something very radical and disturbing, troubling. Something that will shake the foundations of those who seem to be secure. Something that will lift up those who think they have nothing. The humility of the servant, the wisdom of the servant, and finally, the joy of the servant. I always like the vicar who stands up before his congregation and says, "Today I want to talk to you about joy." I don't have a very joyous face, I know that. I freely admit that. Every photo I look at, I think, oh no, Colin, no. I don't look a happy person. I don't look a joyous person. I hope I do come across as a joyous person. The joy of the servant. Joy is an amazing thing, isn't it? It's an amazing thing. Mary is full of joy, full of joy. Full of fear. It's like the old thing, isn't it? Back in the day of the spell checkers on my Apple Mac, back in the day, if you put the word sacred in, if you weren't too careful, it corrected it to scared. Sacred and scared go together, in my experience. If you're going to do something big for God, if you're going to take that step out that God is inviting you to, it's holy, but it's scary. Holy, scary. They go together. That's joy as well, isn't it? Mary is full of joy, full to bursting, like you are after Christmas lunch. Like I used to be in my grandmother's house, yeah. Far too much. And then she'd put tea on, far too much. Full to bursting. Full of joy. And Mary sings, isn't it? It's the song of Mary. She can only sing, she can only express herself. What do you do when words fail? You turn to music, you turn to song. The power of the song, the power of music, of melody, of words and melody going together. That's what Mary's doing. She's bursting, not with herself. Many examples in the world of people who are full of themselves. I won't go into it. But Mary is full of God, full of joy, full of hope. And people may say, oh, well, you know, there's all sorts of problems ahead. You know, what's it going to be like? What's going to happen? Mary has the prophetic insight, I believe, to understand those things and to ponder those things and to take those things and to hold those things. Because those things will come. We follow Luke's gospel through. Those things will come. Of course they will. We all know that. We know that in our own lives. But yet, we are full of joy as God's people. And it's infectious. It's infectious, isn't it? Sharing the good news. Sharing the good news, and the shepherds will do it. I'm stealing the material, but the shepherds will go and tell others about Jesus. Christianity, I believe, cannot be taught. Well, it can. It can. Well, I've tried over the years to teach it. It can be taught and should be taught, but primarily, fundamentally, Christianity is caught, isn't it? It's caught. It's infection. Something we willingly allow to come into our lives. The goodness of God, the greatness of God. And the scandal of God, because God comes to individuals. He comes to individuals. He comes to individuals and changes them and bids them change their world. And he comes to God, he comes to each of us in simplicity as he comes to Mary, and he invites us to be part of it. And he invites us to surrender ourselves to his loving purposes. That's the challenge, isn't it? The challenge of Mary. Her choice was to say yes. And that remains our choice, because God doesn't overwhelm us. He allows us to choose. He allows us to invite him in. And he allows us to be his people, his godly servants, by his grace. Amen.